Hi everybody, today is Friday, May 30th, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
What the hell happened to May, man? We were just talking, it was May 1st, you know, boom, gone.
Yeah, it's gone. Exactly. Larry, let's start with the situation between the United States and Iran, and there are a lot of speculation right now that they're going to get a deal as maybe sooner than we expected. And the foreign minister of Iran came out, said we are not there to reach an imminent deal with the United States. And we know they're diplomats, they're not going to inform us what would happen. But here is what Donald Trump said in terms of the way that he's dealing with Netanyahu and Iran.
Back at Iran, did you warn Prime Minister Netanyahu against taking some sort of actions that could disrupt the talks there in a phone call last week?
Well, I'd like to be honest. Yes, I did. Next question, please.
Mr. President, double laugh on sanctions.
I did, yeah.
If Senate Republicans want to push
it's
forward,
not a warning. I said, I don't think it's appropriate.
What exactly did you tell him?
I don't think it's appropriate. We're having very good discussions with him. And I said, I don't think it's appropriate right now. Because if we can settle it with a very strong document, very strong, with inspections and no trust. I don't trust anybody. So no trust. I want it very strong where we can go in with inspectors. We can take whatever we want. We can blow up whatever we want, but nobody getting killed. We can blow up a lab, but nobody's going to be in the lab as opposed to everybody being in the lab and blowing it up, right? Two ways of doing it. Yeah, I told him this would be inappropriate to do right now because we're very close to a solution. Now, that could change at any moment. It could change with a phone call. But right now, I think they want to make a deal. And if we can make a deal, save a lot of lives.
Yeah. Your take in the way that Donald Trump is dealing with somehow, we can say, Republicans together with Netanyahu.
Well, I don't know if you saw the report from the Middle East Spectator this morning. You know, it came out, or I guess it was late yesterday, but that Trump ordered the Pentagon to halt coordination for joint American-Israeli strikes on Iranian nuclear facilities. I've been aware, I won't say for how long, but let's say within the last 2 weeks, that orders had been issued to the U.S. military elements that operate under Central Command's authority that would it laid out how they were going to do the attack on Iran. So the fact that it's been reported that Trump has ordered them to stand down, if true, I say is a very hopeful sign. Well, I think one of the factors that's at play here for Trump to try to conclude a deal with Iran is he's getting pressure from Israel to bomb Iran, but he's getting pressure from Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirate to cut the deal with Iran. And, you know, Trump needs a deal somewhere because, you know, things aren't going well for him in terms of his, you know, he launched all the tariffs on the world. Then a court suspended it. Then a court said, no, you can continue doing the tariffs while this court case is heard. But despite Trump's prior claims that, oh, man, they're lining up to kiss my ass to conclude a trade deal, the only significant, it's not even a significant deal. The only deal that got done was with the United Kingdom, for God's sake. So Trump now has touted these big financial deals with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates. And, you know, those countries are smart enough diplomats to know not to confront Trump in public over this. But I think privately they told him, we need to see you do something and moving this ball forward, and you need to cut this deal with Iran. So maybe that's at play. It's still, you know, Trump was talking, you know, now four days ago. Oh, yeah, a deal's imminent. Well, it hasn't quite turned out that way. And I think he's going to get a little frustrated. You got the combination of the Iran deal and then the alleged ceasefire with between the Palestinians and Israel. And none of them have come to fruition yet. So and now we're at Friday, and Trump would sure like to have some good news to announce before starting off the weekend.
Actually, Axios reported that the Arab states, we're talking about Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and UAE, they have asked Donald Trump not to go to war with Iran because that would bring a lot of problem for their countries. They're going to be involved in that sort of war.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just about the United States and Israel. It's about the region being involved.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Which is quite a turnaround, you know, over the... and all of this sort of revolves around Israel, because if you go back prior to 1980, the focus for the United States was against all these Arabs trying to kill the Jews in Israel. That was the sort of the, let's call it the theological and ideological framework for the policy. Then it shifted to being against Iran. Iran became the enemy. And the Arabs and then the United States sort of pivoted and began cultivating the Saudis and the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, you know, et cetera. And for, you know, let's say for the last 30 years, the United States did everything from a political standpoint to encourage conflict and animus between Iran and the Arab nations, particularly the Sunnis. But then over the course of this last 6 months, we've seen a dramatic change. Well, actually, it's over the course of the last year and a half, because the relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia suddenly were restored. And partly, I think, with the work of Russia and China behind the scenes. But also a recognition that Iran is not this crazed group of fanatics that are hell-bent on destroying everybody else but them. And you've actually had, you know, the Saudi defense minister, who I believe is the brother of Mohammed bin Salman, exchanged very warm words with the Ayatollah Khamenei and other senior Iranian officials. So, you know, it's the worm has sort of turned in that regard. And now that you've got Saudis and Iranians actually willing to work together, it's created a problem for the United States, because our policy has always been to divide, conquer, and use, you know, get both sides killing each other if we could.
We know that MBS is looking for some sort of European Union or some sort of cooperation in the Middle East that would benefit each and every country in that region. That's why they're not seeking for any sort of conflict. That's why they're changing. The new leadership in Saudi Arabia has some sort of substantial influence on the foreign policy of Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, we know how important is Saudi Arabia when it comes to the other countries, UAE, for example, Bahrain, Kuwait, all of these countries. They're somehow following the foreign policy of Saudi Arabia. For the case of Qatar, that can be somehow different from Saudi Arabia. But after all, the whole region needs some sort of calmness, some sort of security architecture for the future, if they think of a prosperous future for themselves. Do you feel that would be acceptable with the foreign policy of the United States, because we know that the United States had a very and has a very important role in the Middle East. And they thought at least that they would benefit from some sort of chaos in the Middle East, which I don't believe that would be the case anymore.
I do think Trump is genuine in his expressions about not getting us involved in more wars. But having said that, there's no denying that Donald Trump continues to take actions that get us involved in or threaten to involve us in these needless wars. So, you know, it's a contradiction. I've come sadly to the conclusion that the United States has no good intentions towards anybody in the Middle East or West Asia, you know, depending on how you want to define it. That we're looking to use these countries and abuse them as we can. We're not at all interested in helping these countries, quote, succeed. There may be that lip service paid to it, but I'm just looking at our history there. We've never had the best interests of these countries and these people at heart. We don't care about these people. Good God, they speak a funny language that we don't talk in America, here in America. And they're dark-skinned and, you know, you know, it's sort of a racist undertone to it. It's you know, like I said, it's sad to say, but you know, look at our history there in the region and tell me different.
And but how about the reality of what's going on? Does the United States want to have some sort of deals with the Middle East when it comes to the trade and all of that, that the United States can benefit from that? Or they want to have the same sort of policy that they had before? Because right now, Middle East, Larry, is so much important. You talk, you know, why, in your opinion, why did China and Russia in the first place try to make a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia? Because it shows how important the region is for these two countries. I don't think that in the eyes of the United States, that would be the importance of the region is somehow drastically different from what China and Russia see in the region. Is that going to, I'm not talking about the United States helping these countries, the United States benefiting from this sort of calmness and security architecture in the Middle East?
Well, number one, tell me what it is that Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, what is it that they export that the United States needs? Nothing. You know, unless the United States decides to stop producing its own oil and gas. So these countries are important more in the broader international scheme in terms of their importance as a supply of oil. Now, that gets back to why did Russia and China intervene trying to reconcile Saudi Arabia and Iran? For China, the oil out of the Persian Gulf is important. Let's call it their new, more in-depth relationship with Russia, they have a more reliable source of oil now that not dependent on the Persian Gulf, but they still need the oil out of the Persian Gulf. For Russia, the importance of the Middle East is, I think they tend to look at this more strategically in terms of noting Saudi Arabia's role in having fomented a lot of radical Sunni terrorism that has been a direct threat in Russia, particularly in places like Dagestan. So, you know, Russia would like to nip that in the bud, get that under control. as well as recognizing that to the extent that the Saudis or the Qataris or Emiratis become a base for U.S. military operations, it does pose a threat from Russia from the south. And so they want to be in a position to try to mitigate that. So Russia and China naturally could work together with trying to bring the Iranians and Saudis together so that, you know, the prospect of war. And you know, and they I think both sides, both the Chinese and Russians astutely recognized the United States was fomenting conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia in order to just want one to try to weaken Iran and go after Russia. So this is a move by Russia to counter that. If you know, I've been preaching of late the Oliver Stone interview with Vladimir Putin from 20. It was the interviews, 4 hours worth of interviews carried out over a 2-year period, 2015, 2016. And if you haven't watched it, talking to everybody of you listening or watching this right now, if you haven't watched it, go to YouTube, look up Oliver Stone and Putin interviews. It's a 4-part because it gives you a tremendous insight into how the Russians are thinking, but particularly how Putin thinks about this. Now, it is, if you like Putin now, before you watch it, you'll come away impressed as hell with him. He is not, he's not an emotional child like Donald Trump. He's a lawyer, which, you know, I could do lawyer jokes, but we won't. But he approaches things much like lawyers do in terms of the methodical thinking and looking at it from a standpoint of what's the risk, what's the benefit, what do we do to mitigate risk? And, you know, that's how they're approaching this situation with respect to the Middle East, at least from Russia's standpoint. So they're defusing it. And, you know, I think that's been, it's been a bit, very much a frustration for the deep state in Washington, which is part of the reason they hate Putin, despise him, because he's thwarting their plans. The United States, you know, unfortunately, the United States' desire, I'm not saying that Trump necessarily shares this, but the desire is to control the world, period. That we will be in charge and nobody else can do or say anything.
Larry, did the government in Ukraine try to attack the Russian president when he was on his way to the Kursk region?
No. Western intelligence tried to attack Putin and they used Ukraine as a proxy. You know, this was a legitimate assassination attempt on Putin. And again, it illustrates the stupidity of these folks in the West. If they think that getting rid of Vladimir Putin is going to make their life easier, boy, they have no idea what they're dealing with in Russia. Putin is seen by many as being too soft, yet his calmness and his thoughtfulness about dealing with the threat from the West has prevented a nuclear war. I guarantee you, if Putin is removed from the scene, the next most likely person in charge is Medvedev, and he's not going to hesitate. There would already be bombs fall or Reshnik missiles hitting Berlin, Paris, and London, and U.S. military bases in Germany, among others.
When you put Donald Trump in the position as he is in the position of the president of the United States, don't you feel that he's somehow getting out of the hand, even by his standards, even by his sort of reality? The way that he's attacking the Russian president doesn't make sense to anybody. I don't see it differently from what Joe Biden has tried to name Colin Poon and just all of those stupid policies that didn't work for the foreign policy of the United States. Why? What is he trying to do right now?
Well, it's only one of two possibilities. Either his staff is not briefing him and telling him what happened, why Russia hit Ukraine as it did over the weekend, last weekend, the 24th and 25th. They're not telling him that, or he knows exactly what happened and he's lying. I don't think Trump's a very good liar. I think he genuinely has not been properly informed or briefed, that he's being fed a narrative as well. And the unfortunate thing is he doesn't realize he's being fed a line of male bovine excrement, and he's not challenging or pushing back. If he knew that the Ukrainians had launched over 1,400 drones against Russia in the preceding days, before Putin retaliated with 548 drones and 83 ballistic missiles, that would have put a different spin on it, especially if he knew that there had been an attempt to kill Putin with drones while flying to Kursk. But then on top of it, Trump wasn't properly informed about the casualties. It was implied that, the Russians were just killing hundreds, if not thousands, of Ukrainian civilians. Absolutely not true. In fact, there's a very, very low number of civilian casualties. So, albeit there were 30, which is probably 30 too many still in some eyes. But when you're looking at 548 drone strikes and 83 ballistic missile strikes, and only 30 civilians died, that tells you that this was a concentrated strike on military targets. There's no other way to interpret that. And Trump, again, glossed over that. And then when asked directly about, did he know that there had been this attempt to kill Putin? I didn't know that. Maybe that could explain it. So he's out of touch with reality. And that's, I know in talking to Doug McGregor previously, that he explained he saw sort of similar things when he was part of the first Trump administration.
Larry, when we talk about the drone attack on Vladimir Putin, it comes in my mind, comes from the frustration, it comes from the desperation on the part of Ukrainians right now. They're not in a good position. They're trying to negotiate with Russians. They know they cannot force Russia for any sort of articles, that they're going to put in the agreement. But when you look at the way, because without the United States, because without the intelligence provided, as you mentioned, with the security part of security structure of the Trump administration, who can imagine that Ukrainians were able to attack Vladimir Putin? And why?
Well, they couldn't do it without U.S. and British intelligence support. And I do not believe that Donald Trump ordered that. Is it possible that this was done within the CIA ranks with John Ratcliffe's knowledge? Possibly. And it's also possible that even Ratcliffe was not properly informed about the passage, passing intelligence to the Ukrainians that they could use to go after Putin. So I'm not sure it was necessarily an official decision by the U.S. government, but nonetheless, I think U.S. intelligence assets were involved in it. So therefore, we're complicit.
So is that going to be, who's responsible for that? Is Donald Trump interested in putting pressure on, I don't know, the head of CIA, maybe Tulsi Gabbard, to see what was the outcome of their assessment, why he was not aware of what's going on?
I admire your naivety. That's not a criticism. but you are asserting that there's something called accountability in Washington, D.C. Man, nobody's held accountable for anything. You know, Doug McGregor told me the story of, you know, Trump said, hey, I want to pull the troops out of Afghanistan. And so he said, give me a plan. How do we do it? And McGregor told him, here's what you do, you know, pull back to Bagram and, you know, laid it all out. So Trump issued an executive order to do it. And that order was sent over to the Pentagon. And remember, Kash Patel, the new FBI director, he was like the deputy over there at the time. And when the Pentagon got that, they went crazy. They basically said, hell no, no, we're not doing this. And did Trump fire anybody? No. Did Trump hold anybody accountable? No. You know, that's one of the big problems with Donald Trump. He played this character on television as this guy, ultimately, you're fired, you know, I know how to build a business. But he gets, you know, he reportedly is actually pretty soft. And he's not he likes to play the tough guy, but he's not a tough guy. He's actually, you know, pretty kind in reality. You know, he's insecure and wants to be liked. But as a consequence of that, he does, you know, people don't get held accountable. Now, we've had a number of changes recently in the National Security Council where over 100 staffers were reportedly booted. You know, we still haven't heard any real story what was behind that, who made the decisions. But, you know, was Trump briefed on that? Probably. But again, Trump's not holding anybody accountable in this. That's the problem.
Larry, working in the federal government, I know how does it work. Somehow the people, lower rank people, they can do something that the people on the top, they're not aware of what's happening.
Once you understand, I think one of the mistakes many people make when they talk about the CIA as this nefarious outfit is that they forget it is a large bureaucracy. And so when you're talking bureaucracy, you're talking a hierarchy, you're talking a pecking order, you're talking a system of what's an acceptable way to do things and what's an unacceptable way to do things. And within that bureaucracy, those that step outside the lines, those that are seen as rocking the boat, they get isolated, sanctioned, punished, fired. So it's a kind of environment, and this doesn't just apply to the CIA. This applies to all large bureaucracies. It encompasses a culture or encourages a culture of people that go along, that they go with the flow, they go with the crowd, and while I don't believe that Trump necessarily ordered the attempt to go after Putin, I believe somebody in Trump's senior staff did, and the CIA was carrying that out as an order, because the CIA doesn't want to run the risk of doing things that the president or political authority hasn't ordered, because then at the end they're responsible. And the last thing you want within these bureaucracies is to, quote, be responsible for something.
Does Trump appreciate the role of the United Kingdom in Ukraine? Because when you look at the ambassador, Ukrainian ambassador, I don't know Ukrainian ambassador to Germany, to France, even to the United States. I know who's the Ukrainian ambassador to the United Kingdom. This shows how important is the United Kingdom in the conflict in Ukraine. But is it going to be appreciated by Donald Trump himself and his administration?
Oh yeah, no, I think Trump does understand that the UK plays a big role, and that's why Trump has basically kicked a lot of the responsibility to the UK. Okay, you guys want to do this? Go ahead, knock yourselves out. And it's exposing the UK as incapable of carrying it out. you know, again, you know, you've got all this backdrop, but I wonder if Trump is getting briefed on, let's call it the Starmer sex scandal or the alleged sex scandal. That here he is, he's got basically three Ukrainian male models torching his house or involved with some attacks on his property. You know, there's a lot believe that it's a jilted lover theory. You know, maybe so, but you know, Starmer is in political trouble at home, and it's not going to get easier or better for him. And so I think, you know, Trump, I always wonder if Trump is seeking revenge on the Brits for their role in Russiagate, in trying to destroy him prior to his election as president and continuing to collaborate with the CIA and FBI and the National Security Agency and using intel against Trump, you know, trying to fabricate intel to use against Trump.
We know that Russia has captured another region in the Kharkov region, right above the map. But as they talk about right now, they're talking about this sort of line as a buffer zone from Odessa and Nikolaev going up to Kharkov. In Sumy, they're fighting. In Kharkov, they're fighting. And right now, they're talking about they're going to talk with Ukrainians. They're prepared to talk with Ukraine. Ukrainians have confirmed that the talk would be in Istanbul. How is that the reality on the ground, the reality on the battlefield, is going to influence the talks that are going on that are going on right now between the two parties, and they're gonna have a new round of talks?
Well, Russian military progress, not just in the four regions that voted to join the Russian Federation, you know, so Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson and Zaporizhia, you know, they all voted in September of 22 to become part of Russia in the same way that the Crimea did back in 2014. So what Russia's doing on the battlefield, it's going to extending operations into Kharkiv, Sumy. It's going to be going into Mykolaiv, I believe. And Dnipropetrovsk, and you know, part of the goal of this is not a negotiating tactic on Russia. It's part of their military campaign. They are going to militarily defeat Ukraine, and in the process, defeat NATO, because Ukraine is a proxy army of NATO. It has been a member of NATO as a de facto member of NATO for more than 30 years. So this is Russia's way of delivering a message. Nonetheless, in these negotiations, they're giving the Ukrainians a chance to put a stop to the war now. But that means, according to the Russian demands, you accept Crimea and these four oblasts as now part of Russia, officially accept that. Don't argue it. Withdraw your military forces and get rid of the Nazi elements in your government. That's got to go away. That's not going to be allowed. Now, Ukraine's not going to accept that for right now, at least the current Ukrainian leadership. And Russia said, okay, that's your choice. We're going to continue the war, and they're going to continue the war, and they're going to militarily defeat them. These Western analysts that continue to argue, oh, this is a stalemate. Nobody can win this militarily. You know, indulge your fantasy, but that's not true. It's a lie.
If not militarily, Larry, that the question would be, what else that could be? Do you see Ukrainians accepting the terms on the part of Russians? Because right now they're talking to each other. As we've learned from Maria Zakharova, she said that it's going to be just the two parties, no one else involved, Europeans, not the United States.
Right.
how is that possible to convince Ukrainians?
Well, remember that the Ukrainians and Russians came to an agreement, a tentative agreement, back in April of 2022. And that, that then Ukraine walked away from that agreement under pressure from the Boris Johnson and the Biden administration. So, you know, the Ukrainians got to make a decision. How much do they want to survive? You know, it's a corrupt enterprise. The people around Zelensky have been making money. I don't know if you saw this one claim by a Hollywood actor, Danny Trejo. And Trejo was going to go to Ukraine and do, you know, some publicity for the Ukrainians. And he was, you know, wanting a fee of $100,000. And the Ukrainians came back and said, oh, no, it's going to be $150,000. But you give that $50,000 to Umarev, which is basically Zelensky's.
He's the head of negotiators right now, yeah?
Yeah, maybe he's the head of negotiators. Yeah, he may be. So, you know, there's that level of corruption there. And, you know, so this is going to end badly for Ukraine. The question is just, you know, how devastating the end will be.
Yeah. With Germany and the United Kingdom and France, they're talking about lifting restrictions on the range of weapons to be used in Ukraine. Do you feel that Donald Trump would allow them to do that? Or does he have any sort of leverage on them to manage that?
Yeah, he does. He has leverage as far as the use of the Taurus. Now, what makes the Taurus particularly a threat is the fact that a nuclear warhead can be, it can carry and deliver a nuclear warhead, whereas Storm Shadow and ATACMS cannot. But that said, the Taurus is still not capable of reaching Moscow. It has a range of 300 miles. You know, it's like 500 kilometers. The distance, if you go from like Kharkiv to Moscow by a direct, direct line of flight, it's about 400 miles. So it falls about 100 miles shy. That said, where this missile would have to be launched from is probably much farther back. So it's not going to hit Moscow, but it would go farther into Russian territory. But the concern, I think, for Russia is not so much the depth as what the capability of that particular missile is, capable of carrying a nuke, because you have no way of knowing, does it have a nuke on it or not? And so that's where Russia is making, you know, this as a red line. And why the West needs to be very cautious, because several Russian officials, including Medvedev, a couple of generals, indicated if such a missile's fired at them, not only will they hit the site that launched the missile, but they will hit Germany, who produced the missile. They made that very clear, and it was following that declaration by the Russians that Friedrich Merz backed down. By the way, you know, you're too young to know this, but were you ever familiar with there was a terrific American television show in the United States called I Love Lucy with Ricky Ricardo and, Desi Arnaz playing Ricky Ricardo and Lucy, Lucille Ball, the comedian. And their neighbor upstairs was a guy named Fred Mertz. Yeah, if your viewers, they should go online and look for I Love Lucy with Fred Mertz. And, you know, he's like the exact opposite of the current Friedrich Mertz. But he's a comical figure nonetheless.
Yeah. No worry, Joe Biden, before leaving Washington, he was somehow so much insisting that NATO is getting stronger, is getting better. We have new members in NATO. But right now, when we see the reality of what's going on in Europe, you see nothing but division. You see nothing but difference. And do you think that they're, if we take out the United States from Europe, are they going to be able to understand, to communicate to each other? Right now, huge differences are just getting out, and everybody just, before it somehow, the Biden administration was trying to cover everything. Right now, that is not happening with the Trump administration.
Yeah, well, you know, what we're witnessing is the end of an empire. And, you know, think back, you know, there was a time when the United Kingdom, Great Britain, was a genuine, it was a global empire. They controlled vast portions of the world. They were colonial masters in India and South Africa and the Caribbean. And, you know, rule Britannia, Britannia rule the waves. Remember that song? But, you know, starting with World War One, the collapse of British imperial power started. And, you know, World War II actually sort of was the death knell. Now, when that happened, you know, the entire economy of Britain didn't collapse and people weren't dying by the millions and the cities weren't on fire. You know, there was no Hollywood ending to it. But the situation from Britain's standpoint had changed. And now we're, I don't know if you, did you ever watch the movie Game of Thrones or that television series Game of Thrones? So in one of the themes in it was they had these dragons that came back to life, these huge dragons. But they showed that before the dragons had supposedly died out, they had shrunk to the size of, like, you know, little dogs. And were very weak, and that's actually what we've seen. Britain went from being this giant dragon, fire breathing, and capable of causing mayhem around the world, to now it's just this, you know, nasty little skinny thing that, you know, it doesn't have 100 ships in its navy necessarily. It can't recruit enough sailors to keep its ships afloat. Its army is, you know, it can barely fill cannot fill a soccer stadium, a good football stadium in London or in the UK. So that's what we're witnessing now with the United States. The United States, its supremacy, its power within the world has, you know, it's dissipated, and we're not willing to, you know, the many in the United States are still in denial about it and still pretending that we're something that we're not. And meanwhile, Russia has re-emerged, risen from the ashes like a phoenix rising, that its economy is strong, and it has a national identity that's vibrant and alive. And it's got an approach for dealing with other countries that stands as just the exact opposite of that of the United States, where the United States is seeking to abuse and control, or Russia is seeking partnerships and offering friendship.
When would be that moment with the situation that you're describing to us? When would be that moment for the United States to decide that the reality is somehow different from what they had in their mind, and they have to decide, they have to go after a new sort of strategy in dealing with superpowers, with regional powers, with the benefit that the way that they can benefit from these enemies or counterparts or whatever they can call it, the other side? They can change it. They can learn from what Russia is doing. They can learn from what China is doing. They're getting benefit from this behavior of the United States. Everybody's getting benefit from this behavior of the United States, because as time goes by, it's getting much more obvious for everybody to understand that.
Well, the only way Russia came to understand that was with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And it was in the suffering of that collapse. I mean, recognize that like 92% of the population was in some level of poverty. The middle class shrunk to, in 1995, it was like 7% of the population was considered middle class. The lifespan of the average Russian, particularly Russian men, went from like 63 to 56, you know, in a very short period of time, which means you had a lot of people dying. So there was a lot of incredible suffering that they went through. And it was in the face of that suffering, out of it, that, you know, Vladimir Putin came to power. You know, if you want to believe in this, I'll call it divine intervention, I think maybe this was an example. Because Putin was not some ideologue who had been sitting writing like Mein Kampf and how I'm going to take over the world. He got thrust into a position of responsibility that, frankly, you could make the argument he wasn't prepared for. And, you know, in the West, the stupid meme, oh, he was a ruthless KGB officer. He was a lawyer in the KGB. I've known lawyers at CIA. Yeah, good lawyers. But, you know, they're not field operatives out, you know, killing people. And the lawyers, sort of the mentality, the way they're trained is to minimize risk, not to accept risk, not to find more risky things to do. So, in fact, Putin resigned from the KGB when the civil war broke out in Russia in 1991, because he didn't want to align himself with what he saw as an institution that would be attacking the people. But over the course of the last 26 years, the transformation that's taken place in Russia is profound. So I guess what I'm saying is, I think, unfortunately, the United States is going to have to go through a similar kind of crisis, of utter economic devastation. And candidly, you know, we're well on the road to that, given that our debt, right now, the interest that's paid on American debt, U.S. debt, exceeds the $1 trillion budget that Trump is proposing for the Department of Defense. And Trump's effort to, if you will, re-energize the American economy by bringing industry back, it's falling short. Remember, he promised, oh, all these countries are lining up to kiss my ass, and we're gonna have business deals, and he's only got one deal cut with the UK. And that's, you know, that really doesn't bring the United States anything of any value. And we'll see what decisions the United States makes going forward. But you know, if we were thinking rationally, one of the things we should do immediately is, okay, we're going to end U.S. military presence overseas. We're going to cut and close bases. We're going to end. We're going to stop spending all this money and subverting other countries. We're going to make it a priority to invest here in America. We're going to create processing plants for rare earth minerals. We're going to invest in the infrastructure. We're going to provide financial assistance to people so they can purchase homes, so that the level of homelessness decreases. You know, there are a number of things that could be done. And these would be radical reforms. And you know, the only time you get these kinds of radical reforms historically is usually in the midst of crisis. And we haven't had that crisis yet, but we will. And then it'll be in the midst of that crisis that we'll figure out whether we're going to make decisions that will allow us to survive or not.
These people who are in the Trump administration and somehow in the Republican Party who are preaching for new sanctions on Russia, they feel that they can bring Russia to its knees by genuinely believe that, or they're just making some sort of noise for Trump and his administration, or for the part of the administration that is willing to make a deal with Russia?
No, they're genuinely that crazy. They believe it. And you know, again, they're not thinking it through, because they're not really sanctioning Russia. They're threatening the sanctions on India and China. They want India and China to cut off their relationships. What India and China are both coming have come to recognize, you know, again, they sort of naively went through a period where they thought the United States could be a trustworthy, beneficial economic partner. Now they see us as we're like a serial rapist. We're a dangerous criminal. We're dangerous to them. We don't have their best interest at heart. We're going to, you know, literally rape them, use them for our own satisfaction without any regard to what happens to them or their people. And I think both China and India are saying, you know, they're not looking for a direct confrontation with the United States, but they're not lining up to, as Donald Trump said, kiss his ass.
Larry Keith Kellogg mentioned that he said that NATO might be willing to stop its expansion toward the east. And if that, do you think that in the process of what's going on between the United States and Russia, they have discussed that? That's why he's talking about it. It's just surfacing the talks that have happened before, or he's just suggesting something new to Russia before reaching any sort of agreement, any sort of talks in the background?
No. Look, that's one of the central issues. One of the central demands of Russia is NATO. you've got to give us a good declaration and a clear assurance that you're no longer going to expand to Moldova or Georgia. You're going to cease your efforts to destabilize those countries. Now, the U.S. Congress just passed a law, or at least there's a bill proposed. I don't know if it's actually been passed and signed by Trump, but to punish Georgian officials because they passed a law that's modeled after the Foreign Agent Registration Act here in the United States. And yet, it's described in the U.S. press as this is a Russian-style law. No, it's a law like in the United States, except the United States wants the right to go in and interfere openly in Georgia and to create a country that's going to be under our control that we can use against Russia. The threat of NATO is the number one threat. There is no military justification whatsoever for NATO growing and expanding. They've always used it as, oh, the Russian threat, except Russia did not start building up and reforming its army until 2010. And they didn't actually build up the army. They just started a reformation period in terms of organization, structure, training, modernization of weapons. But it's been since the start of the special military operation that the Russian army has grown, and it's grown because it has been attacked by NATO. Let there be no doubt about this. This is not Ukraine doing the fighting. The United States, Great Britain, and other NATO countries are heavily involved in providing intelligence, targeting, logistics, supplies, weapons. You know, we are an accessory to this in the same fashion that, you know, if I gave you a gun and told you to go kill the president of Brazil and you did so, I'd be as responsible for that as that crime as you would be. So in the same way, the West is culpable.
Fitzo is, Larry, it seems that they're trying in the European Union, they're trying to somehow put pressure on Hungary and Slovakia. They're trying to just not letting them to use their right to veto what's going on in the European Union. And here is what Fitzo said about that.
Of a mandatory political opinion, the abolition of the veto, the punishment of the sovereign and the brave, the new Iron Curtain, the preference for war over peace, this is the end of the common European project. This is a departure from democracy. This is the precursor of a huge military conflict.
He knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, well, he's been shot, you know. A bullet to the gut is sort of great for clearing the brain, helping you focus on what's important and what's not.
The tragedy is that Fico and somehow Orban are not that much powerful to counter, to go against the United Kingdom and Germany. And I don't know how long the European Union can keep it the way it is by suppressing these two countries, the countries who are not willing to be the conflict in Ukraine. And we were talking about the role that the United States can play in helping these countries who are against. But do you see that coming from, that going from the Trump administration?
Oh, hell, well, Trump is more favorably disposed towards Orban than Fico. But understand that, you know, it's been the policy of these USAID, National Endowment for the Democracy, to try to undermine those governments. And, you know, the non-governmental organizations, NGOs, remain a continued source of subversion. They become basically tools of the intelligence community. So this is, the EU's, I don't see them relenting at all in their desire to destroy those two governments. You know, how dare they not go along with the global project? And Europe, look, the only thing that's sort of the silver lining to the dark cloud of Europe threatening war with Russia is that Europe's impotent. You know, they're completely incapable of mounting any credible military threat to Russia. And Russia, from its standpoint, it has zero interest in invading and taking control of those countries. It doesn't need the headache. God, it's just, just leave us the hell alone. Stay in your own yard, you know? Stay behind your fence. Just don't come over. Don't bother us. Stay away from us. We'll be fine. There was, for many years, Russia sought to be a part of the West, but sought to be part of Europe. But, the appeal about being part of Europe is now worn off. And Russian nationalism has resurged, and they recognize, we're a lot better off. We got better friends in the East and in the global South.
Larry, you mentioned the role of the intelligence, the role of the people in the Trump administration who may cooperate with Europe, with the Zelensky administration, and Donald Trump is not aware of that. When it comes to the conflict with Iran, do you think that, as Donald Trump has warned Netanyahu not to do anything while they're negotiating, while they're talking about, do you see the possibility of doing something similar to what has happened to the Russian president, or maybe an attack on Iran, that to sabotage everything?
I can't rule it out. The United States they've been embarked for many years on this effort to try to destabilize Iran. But part of the problem is, even most of the intelligence officers working the issue don't speak Persian. And they don't really know the culture. We've got a cartoon version of Iran as this Muslim theocracy. They don't understand really how complex the society is. And actually how sophisticated Iran is in spite of all the Western sanctions. It actually managed to survive economically. And now it's in a new position in terms of relationships with Russia and China. Something that didn't exist 10 years ago, not at all. And I don't know if you saw just this last week, the first complete train delivery from China to Iran, packing through, they go through Uzbekistan. You've now got the ability to move cargo and trade through this rail line that is not subject to attacks, at least on the ocean, and you know, interference with ships hauling cargo. So Iran is starting to emerge out of the opposition, these sanctions that the West had been imposing on him. Now, if they cut this deal, if Trump goes through with this deal, the deal, you know, I know what the deal should be. It'd be very simple, is that Iran's going to commit to maintaining enrichment at 3.6%. If they require get the 20% enrichment that's required for medical isotopes, medical use, you know, that'll be provided by Russia without limitation. And that in exchange for this, the sanctions will be lifted and Iran will allow inspectors full-time at all of its nuclear facilities so that the West can verify that it's not engaged in any effort to build a nuclear weapon. Iran, Israel doesn't want that at all. But, you know, they go through with that deal. All of a sudden, Trump can legitimately claim, I have now secured the guarantees that Iran was not going to build a nuclear weapon. The problem is the Israeli lobby through American Israeli Public Affairs Committee will energize Congress, and Congress will go just batshit crazy. And they'll pressure Trump to not do it. So, I think ultimately we are going to have a military confrontation. Not because actually Donald Trump is intent upon it, but because of the power of the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee and the Israeli lobby, the Zionist influence in the United States, will push members of Congress to do that and to put pressure on Trump to do it. And Trump is, you know, he's wanting to get his big, beautiful bill passed. And, you know, those bills could be held hostage unless Trump accedes to do what the members of Congress want in terms of both confronting Iran and confronting Russia. That's one of the dangers that hasn't gone away, and people need to appreciate that.
Can Netanyahu survive without having Iran as the enemy of himself and Israel?
No. But he also needs the war in Gaza to continue. Yeah. And yet it's ultimately going to be the death of him. You know, when you saw this week, Ehud Olmert, former prime minister, you know, I had a chat with Alistair Crook the other day. And Alistair pointed out that he used to meet with Olmert about every 2 weeks and have in-depth discussions. And so when someone of the stature of Olmert comes out and decries the genocide going on, decries the war crimes, what he sees as legitimate war crimes by Israel, that tells you what's happening. But, you know, that comes against a backdrop where 80% of the Israelis are in favor of starving the Palestinians to death. Shame on them. This is, you know, they want to hide behind the Holocaust as a justification for what they're doing to create their own Holocaust. It is shameful.
What was the ceasefire that the United States is telling us that Hamas didn't agree on?
My understanding is it's 60 days, but one of the key stumbling points was that Israel was going to be allowed to continue to conduct patrols, even during hostage releases. And Hamas is saying, no, we want everything stand down, we're complete stand down. We don't want any military operations on either side, no shooting, and get the food distribution centers open. I think, the Trump administration was pressuring the Qataris, and I think to a lesser extent the Saudis and Emiratis, to apply pressure. You know, the Qatar is really the one that's had the most access to Hamas, to put pressure on Hamas to come to a deal. And Hamas was sort of drifting in that direction, but then finally sat down and looked at it and said, look, we're just signing our own execution sentence with this. No, it's got to be a genuine ceasefire deal. Now, I think Trump's going to be pretty frustrated by that. And then, you know, Israel's been threatening this Operation Guardian shield, is it Guardian Shield or Gideon Shield for, you know, 2-3 weeks now. They still haven't really pulled the trigger on it full force. And they are coming under increased pressure as well, not just internally from people like Ehud Olmert to Ehud Barak, but also with the threatening of cutoff of military aid from Europe. More even Frederick, you know, Fred Mertz from I Love Lucy, you know, he was out complaining, you know, criticizing Israel. And up to this point, the Germans, who've been super sensitive about, you know, having been try to kill as many Jews as they could in World War II, have been on this guilt trip, so that anything Israel does, oh, that's okay. Now he finally came out and strongly criticized him. So that's a sign that more and more countries are starting to say, look at Israel and say, this has got to stop. Testimony the other day before the UN Security Council was very, I think, powerful. When you had like this one American doctor that had testified about what he saw. And, you know, so Israel's ability to, you know, they're going to continue to cry and play that they're the victim. They're not. They're the culprits.
Larry, here is what the Canadian doctors who returned from Gaza are demanding.
Gaza, when Nasser Hospital Surgical Department was attacked in March, and when Al Ahli Emergency Room was attacked in April. And we looked at each other and we wondered, would our hospital be next? But the staff kept coming to work because they had no other safe place to go, although they were terrified, and they told me this, that they might be killed without their families, or their families might be killed without them. I was home already on May 13th, when my hospital, the European Gaza Hospital, was attacked with numerous Israeli airstrikes, which put the hospital out of service, killed and injured around 60 people. That was a full functioning hospital with patients, families, visitors, doctors, medical students who came every day to study, residents who came to work to treat patients and to continue to study and advance in their exams. As a surgeon, I cannot treat a genocide. As doctors, we cannot stop a famine. So we demand that the Canadian government take meaningful action to enact a ceasefire, enforce a complete two-way arms embargo, prosecute attacks on healthcare, including investigating Canadians who have served in the international in the Israeli forces for potential involvement in those and other.
Yeah.
Hey, look, these Zionists are murderous thugs. You know, and you get accused of anti-Semitism for saying it. Well, okay, yes, I'm an anti-Semite. I hate, despise, find disgusting the conduct of these Zionists, because it's actually a betrayal of Judaism. This is not Judaism. This is demonic. This is devilish. This is satanic. The notion that they're somehow so special that they have the right to take the lives of children, when you've got adult men who have been leaders in Israel's government, openly calling for the extermination of children. And, you know, as I think I said before with you, there was this other Jew by the name of Jesus who made a comment about damaging children. And he didn't say only Jewish children. His comments were about all children. The children are to be cherished, to be blessed, and that woe unto those who harm a child. It's better for them to have a millstone, a large rock tied around their neck, and be tossed into the depths of the sea. So, you know, I let those words stand. Let the words of Jesus indict these Zionist thugs.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
Yeah, you always come to me for the cheery stuff, right?
Thank you.
All right, my friend.
See you soon, Larry.
We'll see you on Monday, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.